I'm Laura Vinroot Poole, and this is What We Wore.
Claire Hornby is the founder and CEO of UK-based Me&M. Claire's inspiring entrepreneurial story includes a mid-career pivot from advertising to fashion and becoming a respected leader in an industry she knew nothing about. Claire, where are you from?
I'm from the north of England, a city called Manchester, which was a very industrial town, famous for its cotton mills. And then it's risen to fame more recently with Oasis, the Oasis
Gallagher's
tour.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, in the 90s, Oasis, but now again with the Oasis tour. And obviously Chanel did their show there. So we've launched a store there very recently. But yes, I grew up on the Pennines above Manchester.
How did you experience style as a child, actually?
Well, first off, it rains the whole time.
Okay. Unlike the rest of England. Wait, hold on.
No. If you think the rest of England, it really rains. In fact, it's nicknamed the Rainy City.
Is it really?
I'm very good at dressing for the rain. So one of our signature styles is the hoodie that we put the style under blazers. And that's my fear of the rain. When I moved to London when I was 21, realised I don't think it actually rains in London because I'm so used to so much more rain. What you realise when if you ever go to the north of England, it's the warmth of the people. Mm. They say it exactly as it is. Mm. They don't mince their words. They're wonderful, down to earth, lovely people. And I came from a very lovely, supportive, sort of working to middle class family. My mum was a teacher. My dad ran a small building company. And they had a very strong work ethic. So it's a great place. If you you grow to love the rain.
Yeah. What was your first experience of style or fashion?
Because of the cotton mills and the textile industry, actually, the northern ladies were actually very stylish. And my parents came from a very stylish friendship group, or that they were part of a very stylish friendship group. So I really learned to love fashion because my parents and their friends were all super stylish. I used to make clothes with my mum. My mum was a very talented seamstress, and we used to go and buy Vogue patterns together and make clothes together. So my eye for detail and a cut of a trouser was sort of born from a very young age. And I worked in denim factories and I ran my own stall on a market. And, you know, that sort of work ethic, entrepreneurial spirit and love of clothes was born quite early on.
One thing I remember was going with my mom and looking at patterns and picking out patterns as a little girl, 5, 6 years old. Do you remember doing that with your mom and having opinions about what you wanted her to make for you? Or was it just...
Oh, strong opinions. Yeah. We went and we chose the patterns, then we chose the fabric. We came home and made them together. And I had very strong opinions about pocket position and shape of a pant. And I think it's funny, isn't it? I always think what you do with your children, you don't know what you're creating then. She just was making, you know, we're making clothes together. Actually needs must in a way. Something was forming in those early years.
I'm thinking what a lost art it is, and that I haven't seen a Vogue pattern except for in vintage stores. I mean, I don't know how people, I guess, do kids not do that anymore at all? I don't know.
You're so right. And in fact, we ran in the kids' holidays, we want to get the kids of them, you know, mums and dads that work in the business. And we actually ran a sort of little fashion centre for them all. And it was amazing. They all obviously loved it, loved seeing their parents working in head office. But I do think it's something that, you know, particularly with AI.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We want to bring those core skills back. But interestingly, most of our designers design by hand, which I hadn't really appreciated, but it's only when you actually sketch something do you really think it through, and you can rub it out and add a detail, and that's when you get the best design. So we recruit designers who can draw really well, because if you're doing it on a CAD, it's too easy. You don't think it through as clearly.
Do you remember a piece that you and your mom made that you love?
Striped trousers.
I love it.
So there's some, we actually became quite famous for striped trousers a few years ago when it was a big trend. And there must have been something in my love of striped trousers from that pair of pants.
When you were a kid, you had a stall at the Oldham Market.
That was my dad meeting a guy at the golf club who had a whole load of faulty shoes that were sort of Italian shoes with faults. And I went down to his factory, made the selection, and then queued for a stall with my dad, and then sold the shoes on the market, and then worked out which were the popular ones, and then went back the following week and got the curation better, and then went again the following week, and it was good early learning. I think I was doing that when I was about 14.
Wow. And did you enjoy it?
I think I enjoyed making my own money.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I enjoyed freezing cold. The freezing, it was an outdoor market.
You went to university and did you study fashion?
Well, no, I studied business.
Oh, okay.
My first job was at Harrods, on the graduate training scheme at Harrods. And I did that because I wanted to become a fashion buyer. On the graduate training scheme, if you went into fashion buying, you had to work Saturdays. And I was really enjoying my move to London and the social life. So I decided to go into marketing.
Okay. And what did you know about buying? I mean, what led you for that first instinct of wanting to get into buying?
I think just because I love clothes. I love fashion, I loved clothes, and I thought I'd make a really good buyer. And my mum took me to a careers fair, and they talked about fashion buying as a career. I didn't really know anything that I didn't know
Yeah.
you could do that.
Yeah.
And I loved the sound of it. That's why I ended up at Harrods and on the graduate training scheme, but then this sort of social life thing took over, which then led to a career in advertising, which I think was the right route to take.
So, how long was the program at Harrods?
So I was only there for just over a year, and then I moved to an ad agency.
What was your takeaway at that point about the fashion industry?
It was my first exposure because in those days, we're talking early 90s, luxury fashion didn't, there was no luxury fashion outside of London in the UK. So I was overwhelmed with the glory of the luxury floor, the women's wear luxury floor at Harrods, and I had a very big staff discount. And if you were really canny, you could run down just as they were setting the sale out, slightly hide the things you wanted, nip in and use your discount and get really great bargains. But I just remember being at full price, just I couldn't believe how much you had to pay for a really well-cut pair of black trousers or, a nice white shirt or whatever. So I think that was there was a seed sown there that luxury was really, really expensive. And why did that have to be?
And so moving into advertising, and was it fashion advertising or was it just standard?
No, it wasn't actually. It was everything but it was all consumer advertising. And advertising is, and back in the glory days of advertising, you work with really clever people. It's about positioning brands, brand strategy. It's about managing the process of an idea that's on is just a script and realizing that it, as a great TV commercial. There's a lot of budgeting and galvanizing the troops and organization. And I worked on the sort of account direction side. So I was the go-between between the creatives and the clients. So marrying up creativity and commerciality. I think there's just many transferable skills along the way that you adopt and you can move into fashion. But yes, I think building brands and understanding customers and information and data and strategies is something that I've taken with me into me&m.
What do you think the biggest learning from the 12 years in advertising was?
Definitely brand strategy, how to build a brand, finding that single-minded thought that you stick to. And then you build everything out from that single-minded thought. You build your culture, you build your product, you build your tone of voice, your marketing, your messaging. Everything comes from one thought and sticking to that. A car marketing is very good for that. Owning something like whether it's reliability, which was owned by Volkswagen, or safety that was owned by Volvo. Some of those are transferable into what we've done at me&m.
During that 12 years, are you noticing that you're not able to find things that you want to wear?
Yeah, so then you become just a customer. In fact, we had a huge Topshop just around the corner from the agency, and I used to go in all the time and look at, I mean, they were replenishing their collections all the time. But I got my daily hit of fashion. I didn't go out and buy a sandwich. I went out and peruse the collections. I wasn't always buying. But yes, and the other thing is obviously the love of the customer, really knowing who you're targeting with what you're doing and why you're doing it. So yeah, customer strategy, brand positioning. But yes, never lost my love of fashion. And then I think as I moved through advertising and I kind of got frustrated and wanted to start my own thing, and every idea I came up with was in fashion.
I think also having children, yes, in that during that period.
I'd written lots of business plans for different ideas. One was an essentials business, da, da, da. And then I had children, but I also had three stepchildren. And my husband had started his own ad agency, and we lived in two places. And I just got very, very, very busy very, very, very quickly. And so I needed to start my own thing.
But I think there's something in that. I think in having children and working and just the way your life changes, but your lifestyle, your body, the requirements of what you have to wear during each day, from getting children to school to getting to work to going to cocktails after, like all that stuff, it starts being like really complicated, I think, and in a very different way than it was in your 20s. Really, for me, I think you realize the holes in the market when you have such a just a full life that requires so many different things from a woman.
Completely. And I was running a business in London, but also dropping the kids off in the countryside that was an hour and a half away from
Oh my
London,
God.
and sometimes going back to watch a match and then back to London for something in the evening. And you realize then the how multitasking what you decide to put in the morning, how hard that outfit's got to work to get you right to the end of the
And
day.
how big that bag has to be to put heels in it and trainers and, like all of the things. It's crazy. And I think the other thing that is interesting is you start to meet other women, the soccer moms and then the people at work, and everybody's having these challenges, and you get even more perspectives than just your own frustrations, it seems like.
And we all put so much pressure on ourselves because we can. So, we can now stand in a Starbucks queue and make the food order or whatever it is. So we can multitask so much more than perhaps our parents could. So we do therefore embrace that, and therefore the insights around clothes, I think, become really interesting because you've got to serve a very demanding lifestyle of a woman.
Every woman, I mean, every woman has such a complicated, I think, lifestyle. And as compared to men, it's so different. Like they need one thing during the day.
I know.
I
One thing, and once they've had that one thing, they then buy 10 of
know,
them.
it's only, but I have a men's store. They only do it like every couple of years.
I need another five navy jumpers, please.
Exactly.
You have a navy jumper, I know this is slightly different.
And so you finally started your first brand, which was Pajama Room.
Pajama room, yes.
And tell me about that. And that must have taken a lot of courage just to jump in and do that.
That was my advertising being too narrow. So the idea was too narrow. It was a wholesale idea, but I launched it direct to consumer, so launched it online. But the ethos of that brand was a good one in that it was all about beautiful fabrics, amazing shapes and silhouettes, and very flattering. Because at the time, the loungewear market wasn't as exciting as it is today. It was a gap in the market. And in fact, we designed this trouser that's still one of our best sellers today. It was a really beautiful trouser to let that it was this sort of idea that you could lounge at home, go to the supermarket, come back. But it very quickly moved to M&M, because it was too narrow an idea. But the ethos is still there.
And was it successful from the beginning?
It was, and we took those customers with us. We were worried that those customers wouldn't follow us, but they did. That got a lot of press at the beginning, and it had great sales. But of course, when you're starting a business, it might have good sales, but it might not necessarily be profitable for a while because of the working capital requirements that go into these businesses. So it was a very, very hard graft in the early years.
You had a partner at the time. Did y'all have people that advised you or friends that did this?
I did actually. We won this award very early on called Walpole Luxury Brands of Tomorrow. And they loved the packaging, they loved the logo, they loved the design of the clothes. But my mentor there was a wonderful woman called Anoushka Dukas, who had started a business in the UK called Links, which was, yeah, do you remember?
Yeah.
And she had sold it and had gone on and produced a luxury version of that called, which is now called Anushka, a much higher end version of that, as I should say. And she said, "Your name's wrong. It's too, you're too narrow. You've got a much bigger idea here. Just change the name." And we were worried about the customers. And she said, "Look, the good ones will come with you, and those that don't probably never were anyway." So she just took out the, she just made us a bit braver. And then my husband was a great mentor the whole way through, and an early investor. So yeah, I'd say those two were great.
And your partner, Emma, was that hard to be on the same page, I guess, with a partner? I've never had a partner other than my husband.
It was, and then actually Anushka took the debate away
Yeah.
and was in that very good way, mediated those discussions. So she got us onto the same page very quickly. She was very good. Emma didn't stay. I think Emma's been out of the business now for, gosh, about 12 years.
What year did Pajama Room start?
Pajama Room was 07,
Okay.
and then me and Em was
Oh,
09.
wow. That's a,
It was
oh
very
my God.
quick to
I always, I mean, it always kills me when people start a business in 2008, 2009. I'm like, well, I mean, it can only go up from here. I don't know that it affected y'all as badly as the states were affected, the Great Recession.
Oh, no. I mean, it was just like if you'd started a business in the 20 years or the 10 years or the 5 years before that, I mean, I think this has been probably, so it's been, we're now 16 years old. So it's probably been the hardest 16 years that you could possibly, I mean, you
Exactly.
know, don't
Yeah,
you?
I do know. I really
When did you start
do.
yours in 2000
No,
and...
1998.
Oh, so you had the
Got
glory
all. I had 9/11, then the Great Recession, then the pandemic. Yeah, I've had it all.
You had a bit of time, but yeah, God, yeah, gosh, okay, yeah. It's not easy, is it, running a business?
No, it really isn't. And I think it is kind of like it's these tests. It's like kind of like knocking you know, the thing when the doctor kind of knocks your knees and like makes sure you're awake. It's like these things that are like jarring you out of like, oh my God, okay, yes, I'm awake, I'm here. I want to do this, you know, because you do have to, you have to really, really want to do it, because it is not that fun. It's not a hobby at all.
No, yeah, you have to have a lot of
You
resilience,
really
yeah.
do. So in the early days, in the beginning of me and M, how many collections a year were you producing?
In the very first year, we probably did one, and then went, oh, how do you now learn from this, and then make another one you don't know.
Right, when you don't have results from the last one, exactly.
Yeah, it's really hard, the first bit.
Yeah.
And I'd worked at Harrods where you saw an end product. I hadn't worked in a supply chain
Yeah.
business before. So I didn't know a single fashion journalist, I didn't know a single supplier. I mean, honestly, if I'd known anything, I just wouldn't have done it. I always say naivety is and was my best friend.
Claire, did you know anybody like Anya Heimarch or, I mean, anybody like that that kind of could talk to you about that part of it? Nobody.
No one.
Wow.
No, I know her now.
Yeah. Too late. So from one collection a year and all direct to consumer, all DTC.
Yeah, always online. I mean, that was just this online thing looks like it's doing really well. I mean, I remember going to my first fabric fair in Paris, and I was on my own, and I went up to a stall and said, "Oh, I really like these fabrics." And they were like, "Who are you?" I said, "Well, I'm this person from this completely unknown brand, and I'd like to buy some fabric." And they said, "Well, where is your store?" I said, "Oh, it's online." And they said, "Oh, we don't do online." It wasn't as glamorous as it is today.
Will you share with us the four F's that you defined as values for your brand?
Yeah, so they are the underpinning of the positioning, which is intelligent style now and forever. The four F's are, we always say if you miss an F, it fails. So the first one is flattering, and that really starts with amazing fabrics. If you don't get that foundation piece right, you know all this. If you don't get that foundation piece right, it's almost impossible to create the
To
perfect
fix it, yeah.
silhouette. Yeah. And it has to be right for the style, and there's a lot of science goes into fabric. And I don't like fabrics that crease, and like fabrics that move with you, but I like fabrics that hold their shape. So I'm a bit of a stickler for great fabrics, which gives you flattering. And obviously, there's lots of other things that go to making something flattering, but essentially, if you don't start with great fabrics, you're fighting a losing battle. And then there's functional. So that's the busy woman, the multitasking. It's got to work really hard for you. We put a lot of design details into our clothes, sleeves that look really authentic, but they might have some hidden elastic in, so you can, source it. You can roll the sleeve, pull the sleeves up to do the washing up, or kirk, or arrange the flowers, or whatever you might be doing. But it's sort of lots and lots of really amazing design details that work to help the outfit be more flattering but also functional. We also look at how many times can you wear it through the week, through the year, so that's functional. And then we've got forever, which is making sure we back things on the right side of a trend. Women want to feel modern, but they don't want to feel like fashion victims. So making sure that we're on the right side of the trend curve. And then the final piece is fair, which is the gap in the market between very expensive clothes and cheaper brands who don't spend as much time on the things I've just talked about.
Is that the hardest F?
Well, that's the one you need to keep the track of the most, because the competition's moving all the time.
Right.
That's the one that you need to just always make sure that you're hitting that sweet spot on price and quality. It's also fair, also covers sustainability and the factories we use. And we've just got an accreditation called Positive Luxury, which is run by this amazing woman in Brussels who's very ahead of the sustainability evolution. So we're really good on our supply chain, and that fair also covers that.
So you went from working in advertising, obviously, I would imagine as a part of a team, but to running sounds like a really big team. What's your how many employees do you have now?
So head office is probably just over 200 now. It does feel quite big
Yeah.
now.
How did you learn how to do that? I mean, you just learned along the way, and you obviously had to do every job, I guess, like from going to the fabric fairs to.
Yeah, so the first bit, well, that's the great bit, is learning everything. So I know every job of everyone in the business. So the marketing team is where I have my strengths, but I measured my own clothes, spoke to my suppliers, found the suppliers. So there is, I've posted my own packages, whatever there is, I've done it. There is a great sense of, no one can really pull the wool over your eyes.
Right.
Really, it's about hiring the right people at the right times and great people. And that's incredibly hard at the beginning, because you can't have, you're in the beginning, you're hiring generalists. And then as the business grows, you're hiring specialists. And if you get those specialists right, then your life is a lot easier.
That's interesting.
And I would say that my board of directors now are, all very strong. And that makes life a lot easier. But you've got to be patient. That takes a long time. And someone said to me, whatever stage of business you're at, you're always two hires short of perfection.
And so, when did you open your first store?
Well, our very first store was actually our first office. So we opened this very tiny store, which was on a street called Connaught Street, just off Hyde Park in London. And then when we moved to a proper head office, we moved our second stores in Marylebone. We've now just upgraded that store, and that's now our flagship. So Marylebone High Street and around that area has always been kind of the center of our gravity. And that's now our biggest store.
How did that change the business opening a brick and mortar store?
Probably not that much in the early days, because it was such a small store. When we really noticed the impact of stores was probably when we got to about five or six stores. And you can start to really feel that you've got an omni-channel business, and you've a store recruit, a customer recruited in store who then shops online is three times more valuable than a customer that shops single channel.
Right.
So looking at those data points and understanding the role of stores to feed the online and the online to feed the stores and how it all links together
Yeah.
Probably was around five or six stores when we really started to understand that effect.
And how many are there now?
In the UK, there are probably heading towards about 15 with concessions in Harrods and Selfridges. And then in America, we've got four and soon to have about seven or eight.
Talk to me about opening up your business to the States. What is that like, and what are your learnings there?
I think we'd recruited a lot of customers in the States through our stores in the UK. So, busy global traveling audience. So we had a lot of customers. We also produce a lookbook, and we'd been mailing the lookbook in America. So we'd looked at where the center of gravity was. It was very much East Coast, West Coast originally. So we started building those audiences out with lookbooks and then digital.
And was the lookbook like a traditional catalog?
Yeah, we still send those out. We still have a lot of customers who love, because everything's gone so digital, so everything's so on screen. It's actually quite nice to have a punctuation with paper, isn't it? Sometimes it's just nice to read a book, not your Kindle. It's like, I think, sometimes it's nice to read the papers on a Sunday, not on your iPad. I think there are moments in the week where you just want some paper.
I want to ask you this about the catalog, because we do a Christmas catalog and we look at the data and we're like, well, we sold this, but we didn't sell any of this. How do you, I guess, consider the catalog profitable or not profitable?
Back in the early days, we absolutely understood the profitability of catalog because in 2009, when we started, that was our only really recruitment channel. So we were lucky in that we understood the profitability of them very early on. But now when you've got multi-channel, so you've got your Meta audience, your Google, you've got, influencers, there's so many more channels to acquire and stores that we now roll that into one pot of money. And then it's what comes off the back of that spend. But what you do get is you are able to match those customers back because you've bought that name and you can match it back. So there is a bit more science to it than.
Than there was originally, I guess. Yeah, that's interesting. What's been your biggest personal and professional challenge over the last 15 years of starting Manam?
The list is long. I mean, where do you want to begin? But I would just say that every challenge, every mistake is a great thing because it's the only way you move forwards, right? And we were talking about that earlier on resilience and actually challenges, meeting challenges head on and making huge mistakes and working around them and is great because you become stronger on the other side and you become more inventive on the other side. And we've all worked through the pandemic, but actually if you survived the pandemic you were a much stronger business on the other side because you had to be so innovative, you had to think quickly. So I'm now 56. There's so much been thrown at me. I actually like bring it on.
A lot of the women I work with have children, and I tell them over and over, I know you don't want to let them get hurt or fall or any of those things, but truly, it really is the only way people learn. It's the only way they're going to be resilient kids. I mean, quit trying to grab them when they're about to fall.
I once spoke to this great guy who, when my daughters went to their new school, and he did a chat on resilience, and I'd never really thought about it like this, but he said childhood is the only time that you can let them run into issues where they've got your support to help them navigate it. But if they don't ever hit those barriers in childhood, then they don't look, then they're learning on their own when they've left home. So actually, the more mistakes they
Right,
can make, the better.
earlier, exactly. Can you imagine starting a fashion business with what you know now? I mean, can you believe that you jumped into this? And you weren't 20. Like, you were,
37 or something,
I mean, did you have a lot of supporters from friends and peers? And I mean, or were people like, you're crazy, what are you doing?
I mean, no one believed in it at all. Neither did I. I mean, once you've started, you have a responsibility to that first employee, don't
Yes,
you? And suddenly
absolutely.
something motivated. You've got some customers, you've got a couple of employees. You suddenly feel very responsible. You've had to leave your children behind, sometimes with a nanny, sometimes with a parent-in-law or whoever it is. And you want to prove to them that that was worth it. And something drives you to keep going. But it's a bit like, I think it's very similar to bringing up a child, isn't it? In the early years, you're just in the fog.
Yeah.
You don't even know what you're doing. You're functioning and you don't even know how you are. And then suddenly they start looking after themselves. And then suddenly they're actually, I mean, mine are the same age as yours, so 20 and 21. And now they're look after me. So it's great. Would you go back and have a baby now? It's not possible anyway, so it's the same thing. No, but I wouldn't start a fashion business. No, but I've loved every moment of it, as I've enjoyed every moment of being a mother, and I wouldn't change any stage, as I wouldn't change any stage of being a mother. I wouldn't change any stage of running a business.
What advice would you give to budding entrepreneurs that want to start in the fashion industry?
I would say make sure there's a consumer need. So really identify very early on why the customer needs it. And then when you've identified that need, really build a sort of framework around how to deliver that idea and stay very true to that, but pivot as well. Even though Pyjamaroom became E&M, the idea of beautiful, well-made clothes for less was still at the heart of it, but I was still able to pivot.
The very beginning of Pajama Room, did you have those four Fs, or that was something that came a little later?
It was actually working with it's actually my husband's agency that listened. They were very good at putting ideas at the heart of businesses. They did it for lots of businesses. And they listened to what I was doing and what I was passionate about. And then they created the Intelligent Style Now and Forever positioning. And then I put the four Fs underneath it. And I've expanded that out as the business has grown because the businesses evolve as well. But I think staying true to your vision originally is what gets you there. And then obviously you've got to evolve and you've got to pivot. But if you come off the track of not believing in what you're doing, I think that's potentially, which is why at the very beginning, you've got to be really clear on what you want to achieve. And it has to be a consumer need. It can't be, oh, I want to make some money. It has to be an
No, it's
insight.
like
Yeah.
what problem are you fixing?
Exactly. It's exactly that, yeah.
I've learned enough. I've had enough British guests to know that you don't have proms there, but you have, I think they call them marquee events. Is that something that you had in high school?
That I didn't have that growing up, but I think it is a big thing now.
Okay, so there's nothing in Manchester like for the end of school or anything like that where you dress up and have a date, any of that?
It's called a leavers' ball.
Okay, and what did you wear to the leavers' ball?
I never had a leavers thing
Oh, okay.
because I didn't go to a posh school. I went to kind
It,
of
it, in the States, it doesn't have to be posh.
in the UK. I think they do have them now. In my children had their leavers' ball,
Okay.
which is their big graduation
Right. And they
thing.
do a dress up.
And there's a big dress up there.
But do you have something from that time, from when you were leaving Manchester? Do you have a favorite outfit from the time, favorite dress?
Probably my first big event was my friend's 21st. There's a dress there that was which was a black velvet dress that there's nowhere I could wear now. Very short, very fitted at the top with a sort of balloon skirt. It was
Cool.
the end of the 80s, so
Yeah.
it was
We're the same age-ish. Yes, I get it. Sounds really chic. Well, thank you, Claire, so much for doing this. And I look forward to having the clothes in Brentwood.
It's so lovely to meet you.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.